I am Madison Timmons.
I'm Chris Susie.
And we're paranormal specialists who live in the most haunted city on Earth, Savannah, Georgia. Every day is Halloween in our line of work, so join us as we spin true tales of haunts, murders, and disturbing Savannah history. I'm Madison.
I'm Chris.
And welcome to the most haunted city on Earth. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the most haunted city on Earth. My name is Madison Timmons.
I'm Chris Susie.
And I'm JT Timmons.
Ah, he's back.
Woo-hoo. I am back.
He's got a face and everything.
You do.
I do.
You're not just a floating image anymore.
I'm not. Someone commented on YouTube saying they liked me better as the face and they rather not have a camera angle. But you know what? That sucks because I got a camera angle now.
He gave himself a camera.
You can't please all the people all the time.
No, you cannot.
It's okay. Well, welcome back, y'all. So today we have a fun episode for you. We are getting this. That's a description, I guess. We're going to be talking about the Texas killing fields today.
It depends on what you call fun.
To JT and I, this is fun. This is a good time.
Very fun.
But yeah, so JT and I are actually going to Houston for a wedding this weekend, which is why this episode's going up ASAP, because we want you guys to be ready for that. Mm-hmm. And so when JT and I travel, we like to film something for the Para Junkies. I know Chris is going to be doing the same thing out in San Francisco.
Indeed.
Yeah, so it's just something fun we like to do. If we're going to go to a haunted place, might as well bring y'all with us. And one of the bucket list items that JT always wanted to do was go to see the Texas killing fields.
I've always wanted to do it.
Which, it is creepy, to say the least.
My parents worried about me when I was a child. But, yeah. They really did.
I worry about you as an adult.
That's a fair estimate. But yeah, so we're going to be going to the Texas killing fields region. Because it's a very large span of land.
I was going to say, yeah, it's a lot to encompass. And and for those of you who don't know what the Texas killing fields are, we will be covering it in just a few short moments.
Exactly. But yes, so we're going to be doing a mini live stream for the Para Junkies only. And then we're going to create an episode where we're going to drive around and show the Texas killing fields on the live stream and also filming it. And then we're going to do some Estes methods and things like that. And we're going to be doing some 360 videos as well.
Yep. And some drone shots.
Some drone shots, exactly. And so, yeah, we're going to be making that episode that will be for the public eventually, but the Para Junkies are going to see it first. So if you want to be on the know of the Texas killing fields and watching us in a very, very creepy place, come and check it out. But yes, and so if we determine that this is an actively haunted place, we will make plans to bring Chris and we will go at night with property owner permission. Because here's the thing with the Texas killing fields, y'all. There are some areas that is public that you can access, but we aren't sure what all is private and what is
not. It's tricky. It's such a large area.
Exactly.
You know, and so it does raise a lot of questions of who owns it, what permissions do you need and from whom? But there is a good deal of it is open public land.
Exactly.
Yep.
And so if we realize, like, because we are going to be going during the day because people are much more accepting of human beings on land during daylight. And so if we determine that it's active, we'll come back and we'll try to do it at night. Yeah. If we have a couple apps, we can try to figure out, you know, who owns what.
Yeah,
stuff.
I was actually going to mention that they're not a sponsor, although maybe they should be. But OnX Hunt is a really great ghost hunting tool because OnX Hunt is a hunting app where, you know, and I only know this because, you know, I'm learning hunting in the last, you know, couple years. And basically you go on the app and you're able to see who owns what land. You're able to see the property lines and whatnot. So you can avoid trespassing altogether while being a ghost hunter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
That is the biggest threat of being a ghost hunter is catching a trespassing charge.
Yeah, because you just want to be respectful too of people's land and whatnot. So you know you can kind of find what's public.
You know, for people dumping bodies.
Yes.
You know, be cautious if you're in an active body dumping place that you don't interrupt that.
Yeah, we're also like 26 miles from another serial killer's dumping grounds.
There you go.
He dumped like 17 bodies in a boat dock or whatever, a boat shed.
It's a rough place.
It's a rough place out there. So sorry if you live in Galveston or this area, because I know we got some Texans in the house.
But, yes, we do.
If you do live in that area, please stay safe.
We love our Texans.
Yeah.
And send in some ghost mail.
Yeah, and send in some ghost mail. But yeah, so let's dive on in, y'all. So what is the Texas Killing Fields? Now, the Texas Killing Fields refer to a desolate stretch along Interstate 45 between Houston and Galveston, which is notorious for a series of unsolved murders and disappearances, primarily involving young women and girls since the early 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
It's also an abandoned oil rigging land, which is creepy. This area particularly is a 25-acre patch of land in League City, Texas, and has seen the discovery of over 30 bodies with four key victims found between 1983 and 1991.
Oof. Yikes.
Yes. Now, the first reported victims in the early 70s were teenage girls attempting to hitchhike, which was like number one way to get abducted in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Why was so, Chris, since you were alive in the 70s,
yes,
why was hitchhiking such a big thing?
Well, you know, it's fascinating because most people don't realize that even the notion of serial killers is a relatively new notion. It's a relatively new thing. Even in the 70s, there was not a lot of understanding of serial killers. Serial killers became kind of like rock stars in the 80s because it was like fresh understanding of the phenomena. We had a sort of understanding. And the truth of the matter is, I think that the danger was ignorance. Mm. People just didn't know to be mistrusting of, you know, kindly people pulling over to give you a ride. It didn't enter into their mind that harm could come to them. And that was just something that's almost impossible to imagine now, is that there was a time when people just relied on the kindness of strangers. That is not a thing anymore. We, you know, I grew up with the faces on milk cartons. You know, I grew up with that notion of stranger danger and all of that. But honestly, 60s and 70s were probably such a opportunity for violent criminals because people were fearless. They just didn't imagine that there are people capable of such horrible things. And I think now we all do.
We're
all pretty attuned to the idea that there are sickos and there are a lot of them. But the scariest statistic of all is we only catch a fraction of serial killers.
Mm.
You know, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that we hunt them based on their MOs, and MOs are not always reliable to catch, you know, spree killers or joy killers or, you know, people who aren't like trying to answer some internal conflict. They're killing for just the joy of killing. And so, yeah, we have a long way to go in our
mm-hmm.
in our investigative fields in that regard.
Yeah. By the time JT and I came around in the 90s, parents and grandparents were like, well, we're going to be a little bit more cautious. JT's grandmother always told him that if because he's a wanderer, he gets distracted. And so he would wander off as a kid, and she always told him that Otis Toole would come and get him.
Yeah, she would tell me that. I was 4 years old, and she said, she's like, do you know the legend of Otis Toole? And I'm like, I want to hear it. And she would tell me about what he did in Florida, very close to where we were. And I was like, and she's like, if you wander off in a mall, that's what's going to happen to you. And I'm like, sticking next to you, Nene.
Yeah, my babysitter was the streetlights. We were latchkey kids. We ran wild in the streets and in the woods. We were never seen, by our family until the very last bit of sunlight, you know, left the sky, and then we come rolling in. Yeah, anybody could have picked us. As a matter of fact, in one of the barracks or the posts that we lived in, there was a naked man in our apartment building just going door to door. And we just thought, how weird.
Yeah.
That's weird. Isn't it weird? How weird.
How weird.
How strange. And
it wasn't even like danger. It was like, huh, that guy. That guy.
That guy.
He's so weird.
Well... The people who were doing these things were also very weird. But
yeah. There you go.
So there you go. It makes sense, I guess, to a degree.
To a degree. It's a learning curve.
Exactly. It's a learning curve. So over the years, many victims have shared disturbingly similar fates, often found or near water, with indications of being bound or, trigger warning everybody, sexually assaulted. So a pattern of young women disappearing only to be found murdered under mysterious circumstances has persisted, making the stretch of I-45 a focus of fear and investigation. So now we're going to kind of go into an overview of some of the victims. Like I said, this is an overview because we do have to get into discussions and things like that. And we're not a true crime podcast. So
right, no, we're not.
I'm not going to give y'all the deep dives into these. But if you do want to know more about a lot of the victims and their cases, there's a really great documentary on Netflix. What, do you remember what it's titled?
Texas Killing Fields.
Yeah, I was about to say, I think it's called The Texas Killing
Fields. Okay, well, you never know if... You never know.
That's true. They sometimes come up with weird names like Broken Dolls in the Desert.
Exactly.
Broken Dolls in the Desert.
Exactly.
What's that about?
But yes.
Oh, it's about The Texas Killing Fields. Well, why didn't you call it that?
Why didn't you call it that? Why didn't you just say it? But yeah, so if you
want to... It's called Crime Scene, The Texas Killing Fields. Sorry.
Thank you. Okay. I knew that it wasn't that simple.
No, it never is with them.
Actually, I think is a movie called Texas Killing.
Yeah, there is. It's got Matthew McConaughey's in it.
Well, of course he is.
All right.
Everybody's favorite Texan. But yes.
Oh, it does not have Texas McConaughey. It does not. Texas McConaughey. Whatever.
Texas McConaughey.
It's not. It's I was getting. Yeah. No. I totally got him mixed up with that other guy, Jeffrey Dean Morgan. I think. Or Sam Worthington or something. I don't know.
Now you're all over the place.
No, they're both in it. I don't know which one he is, but I got him mixed up.
It's a wide variety.
I was going to say one.
Anyone who's seen it knows.
Yes. Well, regardless, that's a good documentary that they did, and they really go into depth about a lot of these situations, especially with Heidi Fi and Laura Miller, which we'll get into later. But yes. Now, Debbie Ackerman and Maria Johnson were supposedly the first victims of the Texas Killing Fields in 1971. So Debbie Ackerman and Maria Johnson were both 15 years old and disappeared on November 15, 1971, while trying to hitchhike in Galveston, Texas. A witness saw them get into a white van after the driver offered to take them to Houston.
Good Lord. This was before even the alarms go off for the white van?
Right. Exactly.
Lord.
And their bodies were found 2 days later in Turner's Bayou near Texas City. They were bound, partially nude, and had been shot to death before being thrown into the water. This tragic case remains one of the most one of the many unsolved murders associated with the Texas Killing Fields, and that is something important to note with these. Some of them do not have a killer associated with it. Which...
Well, and that's just it. You know, there's such a scary statistic to that notion that, you know, especially on the road, over the road killers. There's a theory of suspect zero. As a serial killer that that might be a truck driver, you know, a big rig driver, and can just indiscriminately kill from one side of the country to the other side of the country, and it would create such havoc with the you know, jurisdictions and with all the things that go on, because he would kill people in such a wide range of places, and we would never find them.
Wasn't that how Samuel Little did it?
Yep.
Yep.
Yep. And he's supposedly not convicted on all of them, being the most prolific serial killer. So, yeah, the theory makes sense. Yeah,
absolutely.
But yeah, so if Kimberly Ray Pitchford, she was supposedly the next one in 1973. So Kimberly Ray Pitchford was 16 and disappeared after attending a driving test at Dobby. I would hope it's Dobby because that's cute. Dobby High School in Houston on January 3rd in 1973. Her body was found 2 days later in a ditch in Angleton, Texas. And she was wearing a blue dress, but her watch and shoes were missing. And she had died from strangulation.
Jeez.
The next two were Brooks Bracewell and Georgia Gear. Brooks Bracewell and Georgia Gear were age 12 and 14, respectively, and disappeared on September 6, 1974, and were last seen at a convenience store off of Interstate 45. Initially, some of Bracewell's remains were found in 1976, but weren't identified until 1981 due to investigative neglect. A re-examination of the original discovery site in 1981 led to finding of more remains, along with clothing fragments matching what the girls were last seen wearing. And you see that a lot, too, with any kind of true crime cases in the 70s and 80s and sometimes even the 90s, because forensics just weren't there.
They weren't there. And that's another thing that a lot of people don't realize. You know, DNA testing, very, very new technology. Even fingerprinting was not nearly as prevalent in the early part of the 20th century. So there's a lot going on in the investigative field, and there was a lot that people just weren't ready for.
Exactly.
They weren't completely prepared for the depth of the human mind and how twisted a person can become.
It was also a lot harder because it was so manual, and it was a lot more room for human error, even with fingerprinting, because first off, because there was no database at that point, if they didn't have a physical fingerprint of you, it would be really hard to identify a fingerprint. And even if they did have the fingerprints, sometimes, you know, people have skin that grows and things like that, and new lines appear, and there's room for somebody to be like, it doesn't look close enough.
Wounds, things like that. Yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So it was very easy to miss things.
Even that one case where like a bunch of crimes were all linked to this one woman who didn't live anywhere near the crimes, and it turned out that she worked in the DNA testing facility where they make the tests. And her DNA was getting into all of the tests.
Oh.
So her DNA was showing up on all these crime scenes.
They thought
she was some master criminal. And then I was like, oh, no. She, like, licks her fingers before she opens something.
Oh, my gosh.
No. Whatever her
hashtag
name is.
Worst DNA analyst ever.
Literally.
Well, she wasn't an analyst. She worked in the factory
that put together the tests that
went out.
Goodness gracious.
She's probably like, oh my god.
Yeah, the FBI show up at her house. On the ground.
It's like, oh my god, I didn't do nothing.
We got you, Kingpin.
I don't know why she's Southern in my mind, but that's.
Could be.
Yeah, she might be. The next one was Suzanne Bowers. Suzanne, or Susie Bowers, was 12 and was last seen in Galveston, Texas on May 21st, 1977, heading home to get her swimsuit. Her skeletal remains were discovered nearly 2 years later on March 25th, 1979 in Alta Loma, Texas. Mm. And her skull showed possible gunshot holes, but the exact cause of her death couldn't be determined. Susie's case remains unsolved.
Wow. Again, we're just running through them because we got to get to the paranormal stuff,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we are a paranormal podcast first, but I do have to give you all the details. And
absolutely.
I also think it's important to know.
It is important.
These particular victims as well in the paranormal case, when you're investigating, it's important to know, one, who you're possibly in contact with, what they went through, in as much detail about them as possible.
Yep.
But on the paranormal side of things, I know some of y'all are not true crime people, so I try to keep the gory details brief. But
absolutely.
Now, the next ones are Tina Gale Klaus and Harold Dean Klaus Jr. Tina Gale Klaus and Harold Dean Klaus were a young couple that were found deceased in northern Harris County, Texas, in 1981. Their decomposing bodies were discovered after a civilian's dog returned with a human arm. Could you imagine?
That is not a pleasant situation.
Could you imagine? Well, and that's a thing, too, with true crime. A lot of times it's the hunters and the fishermen. They're always the ones finding right. the bodies.
Well, and a dog, you know, a bone's a bone.
Yeah, know? Exactly. Well, exactly.
Show up with an arm waving at you, and you're like, what you got there? Oh, no!
Oh, no! I don't even know how I would handle... Well, I do know. I would call the police. But regardless, yeah. It's like, I don't know how I would feel.
If you find human remains, call the police immediately.
Yes.
Don't poke it. Don't pick it up. Don't touch
it. Don't touch it.
Don't get involved beyond calling the police.
Yes, exactly. But it led to a search in the wooded area near Wallaceville Road, and Tina had been strangled while Harold had been bound, gagged, and beaten to death. And in 2021, forensic genealogists were able to identify them. Mm. They were one of the few, I think the only couple that was sure. found in this Texans Again, killing it, field era.
It gives you the idea that this is indeed a hunting ground, mm-hmm. and it involves... having opportunity, and what are those opportunities? What opportunities arise? And you know, if you come across a couple, it's like, well, that's not my usual game.
Right?
But.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Crime of opportunity.
Crimes
sometimes.
Of opportunities.
Now, Michelle Angela Garvey was a 15-year-old who disappeared from New London, Connecticut, actually, on June 1st, 1982. It was presumed that she had run away from home, and her body was found on July 1st, 1982, in Baytown, Texas, a month after her disappearance. And the cause of death was determined to be strangulation, and there was evidence that she had been sexually assaulted.
Goodness.
She was identified January 2014 through DNA testing, which has been happening a lot in the recent
right.
years.
Being able to identify remains that have been, you know, questionable.
Mm-hmm. A lot of cold cases have started to get closed, especially after, you know, because oftentimes these killers will offend again in some regard. And so eventually, if they do now in the era of technology, you can take that old DNA and use it on cold cases, and it has helped solve a lot of them in recent years. But Susan Lee Eads was a 20-year-old cocktail waitress and went missing after leaving her home in Harris County, Texas, in 1983. And her body was found the next day naked with bruises and signs of strangulation, which seemed to be this killer's mm-hmm. MO or way of going about it, I should say, using her own clothing. Evidence had suggested that she had also been sexually assaulted, and her case remains one of the many unsolved murders associated with the Texas killing fields. Now, the two that really seem to have brought the Texas killing fields onto the map was the case of Heidi Fye and Laura Miller. Now, Heidi Fye was last seen in 1983 at a League City convenience store. Her remains were found in 1984 with evidence suggesting death by blunt force trauma. But the bizarre thing was that Laura Miller disappeared in 1984, very shortly after Heidi Fye had gone missing, after using a payphone at the same convenience store as Fye.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And her body was discovered in 1986, close to where Fye was found off of Calder Road. Their cases highlight the horrifying pattern of young women vanishing and later being found dead near the Texas killing fields. And with their connections rooted in geographic proximity and tragic outcomes, a lot of people associated them with the same killer.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
You know. The other two that really brought a lot of attention to this was the cases with Audrey Lee Cook and Donna Prudholm. Hopefully I pronounced her last name correctly. Now, Audrey Lee Cook and Donna Prudholm both were in their 30s and were victims whose remains were discovered in the Texas killing field, specifically near Calder Road in League City, which is where JT and I are going to be going, is that area off of Calder Road. And so these two were identified decades after their deaths through genetic genealogy, and their causes in their cases represent part of the series of unresolved murders in the area. Cook was last heard from in December 1985, and while Prudhomme was last seen in July 1991. Now, if you look at a map, and I'll send the map to you, Jabria, so that you can input it here.
I have it.
Oh, perfect. Now, the map, if you look at it, where the bodies were all found, they were literally just in the same vicinity of this oil rig area. Basically, if you go there nowadays, Calder Road is like right here on what would be your, I guess that would be your east side of the killing fields. And there's a little church. And behind the church is a memorial for those four women, which we will be going to. It is not the places where the bodies were found, but they do have like four little crosses there, and they have photos of the women. They have, you know, places where you can leave flowers and things like that. But if you go a little bit further down and you go up the west side of the killing fields, there's like a dirt road. And if you keep going down that for about 10 miles, if you get to the end of it, that's where Fi was found. About halfway through was where Laura Miller was found. And then Cook and Prudhomme were both found towards the beginning of it. So it's like boom, 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 which is quite interesting. Now, there isn't evidence to show that it was all the same killer necessarily, but
it seems like there's two distinct killers.
Right.
Because there's one that seems to shoot. A shooter and a strangler in most cases are two different types of killers.
Right.
A strangler is looking for that very intimate, very, you know, close up and overpowering death, whereas a shooter is, you know, trying to get it over.
Exactly. You know,
it's an act of profound violence.
Exactly. There have actually been several killers that have been suspected in some of the cases, and some were convicted for individual murders connected to the killing fields. So, for instance, Edward Harold Bell confessed to the murders of 11 girls in the Galveston area, but was never charged for these crimes before his death. So technically, we can't pinpoint him because he was not convicted, but he is associated with a lot of the killings in the killing fields. And more recently, William Lewis Reese was convicted for several murders in the late 90s after DNA evidence linked him to multiple cases. Mm. Which kind of shows you, and I think a lot of it has to do with the location, because people ask why this area.
Yeah.
And I think it's because it is so out of the way, but still close enough to two major cities that it's kind
two
of
major highways or a major highway.
Exactly. You know, it's the perfect
that
place.
A big deal. And imagine, too, that, you know, you have these dark feelings, these dark sensations, and you see on the news bodies found here. No killer is caught. And you're thinking to yourself, if I had to do this, obviously that's where I would go.
Exactly.
Because bodies keep turning up there, but I don't see a lot of arrests. So, you know, it's scary to think that of the depth of premeditation. But in a lot of these cases, you're dealing with a deep psychosis, a deep need and urges that are dark and compelling. And they would see, oh, there's a place. They call it the killing fields. You know, it's like there's a place. Where, you know, if I gave in to my dark, you know, desires, this is where I would go. Which is one of the scary things about true crime podcasts about, or even like detective shows. I always watch detective. I love a good detective show, but every now and then I'm like, wow, that was a really well thought out crime. Mm-hmm. You know, the writers came up with a heck of a crime. If I were a criminal, I'd be tempted to try that crime. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, thank you, high-paid Hollywood writer, for coming up with a brilliant plan.
And how to get away with it.
And what do you know? The police force may not have a Sherlock Holmes on call. They may not have some, you know, super genius on call. That's the problem with fiction, because fiction works out the way they want it to. Whereas in reality, of course, those crimes would never be pulled off simply because of their complexity.
And there's also a lot of studies to show that at least they've done this with mass killings in general, is that there's a copycat effect.
There is a copycat effect, absolutely.
Which could have influenced some of this as well. You know, where Like you were saying, people are seeing this on the news and they're like, well, nobody's getting caught. And that seems like actually a interesting concept. Let mm-hmm. me, or I want to be the one that gets caught. And everybody says, I did all these things, because you see that a lot with serial killers because of their narcissistic tendencies.
Yeah, absolutely.
That they want to take credit for more killings than they actually did, because mm-hmm. every serial killer wants to be the most prolific, which, as disturbing as that is, it probably is the reason why there are so many bizarre random killings that right. don't seem to be associated with just one particular.
Yeah, this does seem like many people taking the cue mm-hmm. from perhaps a very prolific serial killer from the 70s and 80s, and then a bunch of others who came in to sort of cash in on the ease of disposing of bodies without being caught.
Exactly. Now, despite these convictions, many murders remain unsolved, and the identity of the killers or killer responsible for the early series of murders between 1983 and 1991 is still unknown. The Texas killing fields have not only been the subject of extensive law enforcement investigation, but have also been captured in the public's imagination through media and film. The area's sinister reputation and the tragic stories of its victims underscore the mysteries that still shroud this section of Texas Highway, mm-hmm. often referred to as America's Highway to Hell, due to its history of violence and mystery. Efforts continue to be made by authorities to solve these cases, but for many victims, justice and closure still remain elusive. Now, when we get into the hauntings, that is when things get a little murky, because there's not a ton of people who have investigated mm-hmm, the Texas mm-hmm. killing field for some reason, especially because there's a lot of investigators out in Texas, which is why, or at least they're not documenting what they're finding out there. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution, though, did write, the killing fields are not necessarily haunted by documented apparitions or ghosts, but rather by the evil that can be found in the human heart.
Well, I mean, sure, but okay. how do they know, right? It's the Atlanta Journal-Constitution or whatever.
Yeah, I know. But like, my point is that it's just giving the note that there's not a specific entity that right, people are running into.
Yeah, seeing of course.
X, Y, or Z. But they are reporting dark sensations, yes. dark feelings, the idea of it. And the truth of the matter is, whenever you go into a place where you know terrible things happened, you are predisposed to dark mm-hmm. thoughts and dark right. feelings. So, you know, it's that's such a tricky thing. Like if you went into a house and you had no idea what the history was and you felt suddenly overcome mm-hmm. by darkness, and then you later found out, oh, something terrible happened mm-hmm. here. That's mm-hmm. one thing. But if you go to a place called the Killing Fields, knowing mm-hmm. that there's countless bodies, probably still undiscovered bodies, and you go out there and you say, oh, there's evil here. It's like, well, yeah, you probably reading a lot into it. You're leading with your heart. You're leading with what you know. It's why a lot of investigators will actually try not to learn a lot so that they're not biased.
So they're not mm-hmm. biased. Absolutely. You
know? Right.
However, in this case, it's well known enough mm-hmm. that you're not going to escape it. So it's better to be prepared than not.
Exactly.
You know, mm-hmm. A lot of times you get those two arguments about how to conduct a paranormal investigation. There are people who want to be clean slates. They want to go in because then when they find something that can be corroborated, then it has a significance to it. The only problem with that is you find yourself chasing shadows in a weird sort of pattern. And you can miss clues mm-hmm. that are being given to you very clearly, right. but because you don't know the case and you don't know enough about it, you can miss those things. Whereas, of course, knowing things, you go in, you might see something and then contort whatever you experience into evidence of mm-hmm. something specific.
Right.
So it is, it's tricky. And that's why having multiple investigators also often helps. You can actually assign someone to be the person out, you know, the person who doesn't know. That way you have someone who has all the information, someone who doesn't have all the information. And as things go, they can validate each other.
Right.
I think because of all the violence and strife there, I think that it's absolutely haunted and we just have to find it.
Well, so...
And you're a young lady, probably around their age, like when they were killed. If there is an intelligent haunting, which I would think that the majority of it is residual, but if there is an intelligent haunting, I feel like if they're going to open up to anyone, it's going to be you, Maddie.
No, and that makes sense.
Might seek to protect you.
Yep. Sure. Well, so here's the thing. It's not necessary. So a lot of paranormal investigators do not debate the fact that the killing fields are evil. But a lot of what people experience there is they feel like there's this intense evil malice that permeates through the land. Mm-hmm. And
definitely.
So I think that's what mostly we're going to experience. But if there is an intelligent haunting, we'll attempt to... Mm-hmm. Seek it out. But the Paranormal Files, they did a documentary on the Texas killing fields where they went out there and they went at night and they found some creepy things, y'all. At one point, they did find a little girl's shoe, a single shoe.
Never a good sign.
And it was like destroyed, y'all. Like it was disturbing looking. And then they also found a piece of fabric that looked like it was used to bind somebody. Like it looked like somebody ripped it.
Like a strip.
Oh, yeah. Sure. And I was like, oh, that's disturbing.
Well, one of the victims was actually strangled by their own clothes. So mm-hmm. Yeah. And a lot of them are found bound.
Exactly. They did also do an SE session for what I watched, and they did have a direct response, which was interesting. But the creepy thing about it was, it would not give them a name.
Oh.
And it directed them to go further into the fields.
Mm-mm.
Ooh.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
That's tricky. That's very tricky.
That is creepy.
And the girlfriend, there's a story of them. It was the one guy who like has the paranormal files, his girlfriend and his girlfriend's brother. And the girlfriend was asking the questions while he was on the spirit box. And when it said that, she pulled him out of it immediately. And she was like, we have to get out of here. She freaked out, y'all.
Absolutely.
She freaked out. Which brings me to my point with this. Because there is so much negative energy in this one area, that is a great breeding ground for kind of parasitic type entities in the way that... it's feeding off of that evil, if you will. Because that's an intense feeling. Those are intense sensations that were left there.
Absolutely.
There's
also room to argue that the land itself is dark and thereby corrupts people's minds to doing dark things. I mean, there's a notion that the evil can be in the soil, and just being on that soil makes a person weak. You know, gives them dark thoughts and dark ideations. There's a lot of weird qualities to a dark place when you get into that. You know, but which came first, the darkness or the acts that brought darkness? You know, it's fascinating because this is such a concentrated area. And what it seems like is you had one very prolific killer. And then copycats.
Yeah.
Or opportunity killers. Mm-hmm.
So I think if we're going to encounter anything, I have a feeling we're going to encounter something that is not very nice.
Right.
And probably working to get attention in whatever way it can.
Yeah.
Because I am sure that there are teenagers out there that go out to the killing field.
I'm certain of it.
And, you know,
dare each other
and conjure all kinds
of stuff. Yeah, and they conjure things. And it's, I think it feels like it has that Helen's Bridge effect. And if you don't know what I'm talking about with the Helen's Bridge thing, go back and watch.
Parajunkie.
It was a Parajunkie exclusive. Okay. So,
become a Parajunkie and go and watch.
Yeah, exactly. JT and I went out to Helen's Bridge in Asheville, and it is like the number one place in Asheville for people to go and do Ouija board sessions or try to conjure spirits.
You know, the killing fields, people have taken their Ouija boards out there.
Oh,
you
100%.
Know. I wouldn't doubt that people went out there and took a stick to the ground and made a Ouija board right there in the dirt.
Yeah,
exactly.
So, you know, it's definitely going to be something.
And when we were at Helen's Bridge, we were not getting Helen at all. We were getting a bunch of other things that were being extraordinarily negative. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, saying things like, I'm going to push you off, or like, you should jump, or you should do this, like through the spirit box, y'all.
Yeah, it was creepy.
It was very creepy. My dad freaked. if you want to see my dad have a panic attack on camera.
I don't think I've included his panic attack.
Really?
No.
My dad, the para junkies have now referred to my dad as the Jesus man, because he's like, in the name of Jesus, get away from my daughter. Yeah. So yeah, I feel like it's going to be that Helen's Bridge effect where it's just something that has been allowed there or has been attracted by the negative people that have put their, you know, dark energy into the area. But
and another thought is, you know, what about the actual killers? Wouldn't, if they are dead, which most likely is the case, wouldn't they want to go back? And, you know, wouldn't their spirits want to travel back if they, you know, haven't crossed over?
That they had, you know, even just the concept of anchoring, you know, although my guess is in many of these cases, these bodies were not killed in the spot. They were dumped at the spot.
Right.
So the likelihood is that the spirit of the killer would be at the site of the killing.
Of the killing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Although it would make sense too that those spirits, and this is a good point, is a lot of people think that the person will associate with the place that they died, or they'd be lodged into, you know, into their homes. But with violent death, a lot of times those spirits are very vibrant, stick around because they didn't expect to die, so they have mm-hmm. a lot of life left in them, mm-hmm. and those spirits are very strong and very powerful because they've been wronged. The life was taken from them, so they're trying to reestablish it, and they get very attached to their bodies. Hmm. Your body is the vessel that you travel through the world in. So, you know, oftentimes if you throw a body into the woods, the spirit could stay with the body, hoping that there was some salvation, some mm-hmm. recognition. And a lot of people think of that as like, oh, well, if you give them a peaceful burial, if you take them and give them, you know, a proper burial, mm-hmm. the spirit will be released. In a lot of ways, that's kind of the notion. You'll probably find the victims because they will be where the bodies were dumped in an attempt to regain their life.
Well, that is actually a really good point because of the fact that there are memorials there,
oh,
too,
yeah,
with
absolutely.
Photos yep. and
that
people.
That will bind the spirit to the spot.
Mm-hmm. And so that's very fascinating.
The memorial area would probably be a good place to do the Estes method.
That's
if
where
we
I
want
was
to connect
thinking.
To the victim.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Because I tend to like to do Estes methods by things like that, because I like to give offerings and, you know, just like little tokens to the spirits. And so if there is a designated memorial spot, I usually like to be around it, you know? Mm-hmm. Because, yes, we could go into the thick of the fields, but it is such a wide variety of space that you could probably just pick a spot and hope for the best. You're not going to be able to, like, we'd have to literally hop from spot to spot to spot, mm-hmm. Which is a very wide range to just go and sit in their direct spots. But mm-hmm. if we're going off of the logic of you know, the memorial is binding them there, they probably would attract more so to where that church is.
Sure.
Which
that could be the spot.
Depending on how religious the people were in their lifetime too, having a church there in the killing fields
sure.
could be actually a comforting
a beacon
thing.
Right.
Absolutely.
You know? And
yeah. We'll call it as we seize it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it'll be an interesting thing, and it'll be interesting to be able to document, too, what we do find, because there's not a ton out there of what people have found. I searched through Reddit. I went through YouTube. Like, usually Reddit, there's almost always a sub-thread of, you know.
Oh, sure.
Of people right. saying, like, I had this experience, blah, 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 blah. But nothing.
No.
Or people don't want to talk about
their
experiences.
They just don't want to talk about it,
which is concerning as well. So, but we'll see when we get out there what we find, y'all. And hopefully, fingers crossed, we make some good contact. If we do, that'll be great. If not, then we know. We know what it is.
Yep, this Friday.
Exactly.
couple days.
Yep. So definitely join us over on Patreon so you can join us for the live stream. And we're also going to do some EVP sessions too while we're going throughout the area. So we'll see if we pick up anything in that as well. Maybe you never know.
Yep.
So with that though, y'all, thank you so much for listening to today's episode. I hope you enjoyed. And with that, my name is Madison Timmons.
I'm Chris Soucy.
And stay spooky, y'all.